So thank you for being here with us this morning. We've already prayed together locally. So if you wanted to pray as you're watching this video, that would be a blessing because then we would all be in one spirit and unified. And I believe that what we have here is, by the way, one just prayer doesn't bring us into unity. I mean, there's a submission to the truth and the mind of Christ in you and all that. That's what unity is. So anyways, just going back to the idea of what we need to understand here. But now what it says in Hebrews chapter 8, verse 1 is now these of the things which you have spoken, this is the sum. So really, Hebrews chapter 1 through 7, through the end of 7, Paul has done what he can to try to explain what he's saying, and then he's going to try to sum it up here in chapter 8. And so chapter 8 and onward is really quite a very impressive part of the book of Hebrews, but this actually follows something, and we're going to see in verses 25 and onward. Paul had said, "Wherefore he," this is Christ, "he is able to save them," those that believe, "to the uttermost that come unto God by him." Remember what John chapter 14, verse 6 says, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No man comes unto the Father but by me," right? So we're supposed to come to God by him. And he will save us to the uttermost, like to the apex of salvation ability. It's Christ that does it. And seeing, in this case, he ever lives to make intercession for those that believe on him. So he is able to save us. You've heard that song. He's able, he's able. That's it right there. He's able to save those that love him, right? So we are with a Savior that ever lives. He will never die. And he makes intercession for us. For such a high priest became us, who is holy, he is harmless, he is undefiled, separate from sinners, and made higher than the heavens, right? And so this Jesus that we have is up with the Father. He's actually interacting with us by his Spirit and the network that he has, and also through interacting with the Father on our behalf. We are extraordinarily blessed. We are like really, really blessed with Christ. So let's go back to what it says in verse 27. He needs not daily. What does he not need daily? He doesn't need daily as those high priests of the Levitical priesthood. He doesn't need daily as those priests to offer up sacrifice. Well, first for his own sins, as it was in Exodus, I'm sorry, Leviticus 16, for example, and then for the people's sins. For this he did once. He doesn't do it every year. He doesn't do it, multiple times. He did it once when he offered up himself. The reason being is he needs not daily as those high priests of the Levitical priesthood to offer up sacrifice. For he did this, well, they, of course, in the Old Testament did this for their own sins and then for the sins of the people. But this, in this case, Jesus did that sacrifice once. He doesn't do it yearly. He doesn't do it multiple times. It's only one time on the cross. And that was the fulfillment of all the previous ceremonial systems and sacrifices when he offered up himself, right? So that's what's going on there is Christ is not like the other priests. And that was what Hebrews chapter 7 was dealing with, especially with Melchizedek and onward. But for the law of the Levitical law, makes men high priests which have infirmity. In other words, they're going to die, right? They fail, they have sin, they need a sacrifice for themselves. But the word of the oath, which the Father has given, which was since the law, makes the Son, who is consecrated forevermore. So he is consecrated, he will never fail. He doesn't need to offer a sacrifice for himself. This is Jesus Christ. Now, of the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. This is like the all encompassing summation of all of what I had previously said in the book of Hebrews, chapters 1 through 7. That's what Paul is saying as he's writing this. And so he's going on now. This is the sum. We have such a high priest who is set at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. He's not on the earth, he's in the heavens. And so this high priest is after the order of Melchizedek, as we talked about in chapter 7 last time. He is a minister of the sanctuary. Okay, and he's not a minister of the Levitical sanctuary, he's a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. Now, this idea of the true tabernacle, it's actually quite interesting because when you go into, like, for example, John chapter Let me see, John chapter 17, verse 3, it says, "This is life eternal, that they might know thee, the only true God." That word true is the same word here as the true tabernacle. And so what we're seeing in this verse, the only true God, we're not saying that there's only one God and Jesus isn't God, because Jesus is our God. We understand that. But there is one true God that has no God. He is the only one that worships no one. He is the only one that sets the rules, and everybody else follows his rules, even his son. This is the only true God. And in the same sense, we have here in the sanctuary, we have the true tabernacle. This is the real one. This is the original one, the one that's always been there. And the one on the earth is a symbol, or a, how would you say, an image of that true tabernacle. Just as Christ is an image of the true God. So just as Jesus is an image of the true God, we have one only true God. And so that's the concept that we have here with this tabernacle. So I think this verse is actually a good one to use when you're talking about John chapter 17 and verse 3 and how there's only one true God, because people will say, well, what do you mean there's only one true God? I mean, does that make Jesus a false God? Well, of course not. So that's just kind of a scarecrow tactic that people have used. And the understanding of Jesus as our God is important. He's not his father's God. His father has no God. He is our God because he is the son of the everlasting God, the one true, only true God. And so that's the concept that we have here with that I think is fairly easy to understand in light of all these thoughts. So the minister of the sanctuary, which is in heaven, and it's the true tabernacle, not the one that's here on the earth. It's the actual original tabernacle, kind of like there's an actual original God. And Jesus is like that true God, but he is not that true God. And just like the one on earth is like that true tabernacle, but it's not that true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. For every high priest is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifices, right? So that's what the high priests were ordained to do. And what did Jesus do? He didn't offer, but he offered himself, right? So he, as the high priest, was ordained to offer a gift and a sacrifice of himself. And that's it. He did it once, as it says earlier in the chapter, or rather in the previous chapter. Wherefore, it is of necessity that this man, Jesus, have somewhat also to offer. But we know, as it says in later verses, he actually offered a better sacrifice. The reason being is because he was one that was the divine Son of God. He wasn't just an animal that represented him. It wasn't a bread offering that represented him. And I've got actually quite a bit of information on the different type of offerings there are. And I'm going to see if I can find it real quick. It's, let's see. I made a whole list. Yeah, there's, let me go back over here. I made a whole list, and it's on my phone right now because I just kind of typed it down one time when I was laying in bed trying to go to sleep, but I couldn't. There's wave offerings, thank offerings, drink offerings, meal offerings, burnt offerings, heave offerings, meat offerings, sin offerings, trespass offerings, peace offerings, silver and brass offerings, gold, vow offerings, free will and voluntary offerings, jealousy or incense offerings. There's plenty of them. So Christ was ordained as a priest to offer gifts and sacrifices, right? So all the gifts of praise and the incense and the vows and all the stuff that the heave offering and all those things, Christ has shown what he will be doing in type in as the one ministry that he does, which is in heaven. It's the in the true tabernacle. He's the real high priest that's not going to die. It's the real thing. So everything else was kind of leading up to that. And Christ is fulfilling that ministry as Melchizedek, not as after the order of Levi. And so we have this idea that Jesus Christ is in the heavens offering gifts, all kinds of different gifts, and all kinds of different sacrifices, all symbolic of his one sacrifice, whereof it is of necessity that this man have somewhat also to offer, which is Christ. For now, if he, Christ, were on earth, what would happen? He would or should not, that's an important word there, he should not be a priest. Why? Because these priests are there and they're offering gifts according to the law of Levi, the Moses law, the law of Moses, or the Levitical law. But if he were on the earth, he would not be a priest according to that law, because he's not in that law. He never was part of the Levitical law as a priest. He was symbolized by the Levitical law and the priests that were there. You see, he's part of the law or priesthood of Melchizedek, which we talked about last time. And so Christ, if he were here on the earth and he was ministering and worshiping with us today after he's ascended, he wouldn't be partaking of the Levitical priesthood. He would be partaking of the law of Melchizedek, or the order of Melchizedek, the priesthood of Melchizedek. And so I feel like it's very important for us to understand that he's done things once. Like all the things that they did per year, he did all those things once. And the only thing he hasn't done yet is, of course, fulfilling the Feast of Tabernacles, which we know it would be well to have a commemoration of, as it says in Patriarchs and Prophets. And if you do some study, I've actually seen somebody do, it's Ricky actually put together a video, and he was sharing that the commemoration that we are called to have in honor of the Feast of Tabernacles has been, according to her own language, equated to the what should be our yearly camp meetings. And I know that camp meeting has, you know, morphed over the years, and it's sometimes you have it for a weekend, sometimes for a day, sometimes now it's even online, and sometimes it's at different times, etc. But I think he was arguing that it would be well to have it around the time that we should, during the yearly festivals and, or the how would you say it, the God's calendar. And sure, I'm okay with that. I don't know that there's anything that is written in stone on that, but it used to be 10 days or 7 days. I don't remember which one that is. I'm sure you guys know better than I do. But I think it's either 7 or 10 days, I don't remember, where they would have a Feast of Tabernacles. Probably 7 days, but I'm not sure. I'd have to look. And he was just saying that the way that it's worded in the writings of Sister White, the camp meetings can be done that way. So anyways, I thought that was interesting. And so that's the idea, is that Christ, he wouldn't be a Levitical priest here on the earth. He would be, of course, as he is called by God, to be a minister of Melchizedek, or the order of Melchizedek. And so they, these people that offer gifts according to the law of Levi, they serve unto the example and shadow of heavenly things, right? As Moses was admonished of God. So Moses was just obedient. Moses did what he was called of God to do. And he, when he was about to make the tabernacle, that's what God called him to do. It was not the true tabernacle which the Lord pitched, which it says up here in the previous verses, but like this one right here, it's not the true tabernacle, but he did make a tabernacle. For seeing that, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern showed thee in the mount. What pattern? The pattern of the true tabernacle, the original one. So that's the one Moses made, was a pattern or a shadow of the heavenly things, right? And so now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry. Who's he? This is Christ. But now Christ, at this time going forward, Christ has obtained a more excellent ministry than the one previously laid out, which was that of Levi. But how much also he is the mediator of a better covenant, not only a better law, but a better covenant, which was established upon better promises. And so this is actually part of what the, how would you say, the disciples, the apostles were preaching, that Christ was in a better covenant and there were better promises. It was a more excellent ministry, because I'm going to try to find something. If I went to Acts chapter 7 and I went to this verse right here, right before that, there were false witnesses that were against this man, and it was Stephen, right? I believe it was Stephen. I call him Stephen. I know some of you would call him Stephen. Like dear brother Stephen here, you're spelled the same way, but PH is pha, not va. So anyways, I have a little contention with that, but no problem. For we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth shall destroy this place, and he will change the customs which Moses delivered us. Okay, so Jesus is actually going to destroy the temple here on earth, and he's going to change the customs that Moses had. Well, yeah, actually, that's true. That was going to happen. And that's what he was preaching, but they were using his words against him as though the majority believed that it wasn't true. And as a result, of course, he was stoned later at the end of chapter 7. But all that sat in the council looked steadfastly on him. And what did he look like? His face was as though it had been the face of an angel. And so they were condemning him for what he did say, and it was actually true. But the whole point of this is that they were condemning him for what they thought was wrong, but it wasn't wrong. Jesus was actually going to send the Romans to punish the Israelites because of their rejection of Christ, and that's why the city was destroyed. And then, of course, he changed the customs because what happens is the temple was rent from top to bottom, the curtain, rather, in the temple. And there was no longer a Levitical priesthood that would carry on as it did from year after year after year before that. And so this whole thing, this whole concept of Moses's law being changed, I find that here in the scripture, it's very consistent with truth. Anyways, going back, and that's what was said here in chapter 8, verse 6. Now, hath he obtained a more excellent ministry? By which or how by much also he is the mediator of a better covenant which was established upon better promises. Why better promises? Why a better covenant? Not because like the old one was bad and the new one is good, but the covenant was made between Israel and God, okay? And because Israel failed, that's why the covenant was now better, because it was actually good on both sides. It was good on the side of Christ, and it was good on the side of God. And so God had before, with the children of Israel, done a ministry that ended up kind of not as good because God was faithful, but the children of Israel were not. So better promises, better covenant, because both sides were consistent, whereas the children of Israel were not. And that's what's happening here with this better covenant, which was established on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, which the first covenant would have been between the children, the Israelites and God, if that had been faultless, then should no place have been sought for the second, right? And part of the covenant before being, not as good is because, of course, as we read earlier, that what happened is there was some of the priests that would die because they didn't have the same endless life as Christ did. They were not divine. They were not the sons of God by nature. And so they ended up, being part of another not as good covenant. So, for if that first covenant had been faultless, then should no place have been sought for the second. And this one is where Christ is in the second, the first one being with fault. For finding fault with them, now with them being the children of Israel, he said to those that he found fault with, Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel. And so this new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, this new covenant is through his son, right? And it's not according to the covenant that he made with their fathers. So the covenant was with the fathers. That's where the fault was, right? With the fathers. So not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant. That's the whole reason. And I regarded them not, saith the Lord. And so what's happening is Christ is the one that's going to come down and make this new covenant with God. And Christ did it as Israel. Now, I'm going to see if I can find something real quick. Well, I guess I'm not. I'm just going to post it up online. But there is a message I presented called, I don't remember what I called it recently, but it's the idea of Christ in the New Testament actually living and fulfilling all the things that he did during the life that he had on this earth, that was illustrating the same activities that were done in the lives of the children of Israel as a nation. For example, Joseph had a dream in the Old Testament, Joseph had a dream in the New Testament. And that Joseph dream in the Old Testament was about Egypt, the Joseph dream in the New Testament was about Egypt. Joseph in the Old Testament had a second dream about Egypt, and Joseph in the New Testament had a second dream about Egypt as well. And so Israel, or Joseph, went into Egypt. And it was Christ that was really the one that was going into Egypt because Joseph is the one that did it. So what happens is, while the children of Israel, or while Christ is in Egypt, there was persecution against the children. and the male children specifically, but that was the goal, and that's what was happening in the book of Exodus, and that's what happened also in the book of Matthew. And so you can see that they were there for a time during the persecution, as Christ was there for a time during the persecution. They came up out of Egypt, both in the Old Testament and the New. Christ was the one that came up in the New. And then after they came up out of Egypt, there was a time where they were baptized, both, you know, in the Jordan River or in the Red Sea. And so you can see that there's a lot of similarities between what Christ did and the children of Israel did. But you can also see that there was water from a rock. Jesus says in John chapter 7, if you want water, come unto me. He was the rock. He is the rock of offense, this rock of stumbling. And also there was bread offered. And so in chapter 6 of John, just like in chapter 7, he offered water. That was in chapter 6, he offered bread. And there was bread from heaven that came in the Old Testament as well. So bread and water was both in the Old and New Testament from Israel and from Christ. And then, so this whole concept of being in the wilderness for 40 and being in the wilderness for 40 years and days, I get the difference there, but that's still 40. You can see that there was all these parallels, and there was 12 in the Old Testament where there was 12 tribes, and there was 12 apostles in the New, and Jesus was the leader of them in the Old and in the New. And so Jesus is Israel. And so that's what's happening here in this concept, which you find Christ made a new covenant with Israel and with Judah, who were his people. But it was in Christ, because Christ is Israel, the Israel of the New Testament. You can see, if you are Abraham's seed, according to Galatians 3, then you are the children of Israel, right? So not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant. That was the fault. That was the problem. And I regarded them not, saith the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws into their mind. Very important. That's how he lives in us. His laws are in our mind. Let this mind be in you. I will write them in their hearts. What is the heart? It's the same as the mind. He's putting them in the mind. He's writing them on the heart. It's the same idea, right? He's just double speak there, if you will. It's not double speak negatively. He's just repeating himself. I will put my laws into their mind and write them upon their hearts. I will be to them as a God, and they shall be to me a people. So we have a God. We have a people. That's God the Father and his people. And his people will have the laws in their mind and in their hearts. They shall not teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for all shall know me, from the least to the greatest. Because, of course, Christ will be there teaching them, right? As personally and also by his Spirit. For I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more. In that he saith a new covenant, what does he do? He hath made the first one old. So the first one that comes with the priests that don't live and the decisions that were faulty because of the people, all those things are now old. All those things are gone away. They're done away with, right? Because now we have Christ as the one that's fulfilling completely. And it says now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away. And how will that vanish away? Of course, the system itself will vanish away with the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD by first Titus, and then, I'm sorry, by Tertius, I think it is, and then Titus later. And so what happens is God's truth is, I think, pretty clear that Christ now is the one that is our high priest. Christ is the one that offered gifts. Christ is the one who is our mediator. Christ is the one that has taken care of all the sacrifices and offerings, and Christ is the one that we are to be looking to, not here on the earth with the Levitical priesthood, but rather up in heaven as he's doing those things, because as it says, if he were here on the earth, he would not be our priest. And so it'd be kind of weird to be hanging out with Christ on the earth in a worship scenario, and you're wondering, like, why are you not the priest? Why are you not leading us in praying and teaching and leading us in songs and various things like you would think he should? And he would be like, no, well, this is not my priesthood. I'm kind of out of place here. And so it just makes real good sense to me that Christ is doing everything that the Levitical law was pointing to that he would do. But now he's doing it. And he's doing it once. He's doing it all, like, completely. He's fulfilling it. And I I just love the Lord that He has offered so much of Himself to do all these things for us as His people. And we can certainly learn from all of what happened in the Levitical system and all the fine points and the colors and the makeup of the materials and the various ingredients of the gifts and the sacrifices and all those things we can learn from, because we have the ability to understand better what Christ is doing now in the heavens. And so I really do thank God and for ministering through His Son to us, for us, with us, so that we can not only be blessed by His Spirit, but also share that Spirit with others and encourage them to study the same things.